Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor.
This week we look at the latest analysis on the general election, we look at the rise of the political spinfluencers on social media, and we look at why the West should pay more attention to what China's up to with regards to the moon.
So, Laura, we're speaking on Thursday morning. The magazine went to press yesterday afternoon. And our cover line is, wannabes, are any of them ready? Looking at the different leaders of the political parties in this election. Can you talk us through the thought process behind that decision?
Sure. Well, it's obviously a week on from when the election was announced, which seemed to surprise everyone, us included, although we did manage to get out new cover pretty quickly, which was pretty impressive. This week, Katie looks at where all the party leaders are at in terms of what's been announced and what approaches they seem to be taking. We've got Rishi dressed up in his military gear, shooting himself in the foot. We've got Keir Starmer wrapped up in the Union Jack. We've got Richard Tice clutching a bottle of rosé whilst Farage heads off to America. So yes, a sort of overview, I'd say, really. To discuss further, we are joined by Katie Balls, our political editor, to tell us more. Katie, you write the cover piece this week and you look at what's been happening in the week since the general election was called. The timing was obviously something of a surprise for everyone, us included. What's been the latest reaction within the Tory party?
I think Tory MPs have been in a state of discombobulation, really, ever since their announcement. Now, you do get a couple who say, oh, it's very wise, Rishi's brilliant, and this is the best decision, and they think they can make something of it. But generally, most MPs are still quite perplexed, and I think it's the combination of a date they did not think was wise and also being almost sprung out of nowhere. Yes, there are rumours of a summer election, but, you know, speaking to MPs, I mean, last weekend, they all had to use the same software to get their leaflets. And because so many had not been preparing, it all broke down because you had hundreds trying to do their leaflets at once with that, you know, the wheel of doom you sometimes get. And I think, you know, things like that, they feel they've been bounced into position. And I quote one minister actually in the piece, who says, you know, this is a week on. So I would say this suggests they haven't really calmed down. It's an absolutely crazy decision. It's the dumbest thing that has ever happened. So there we go.
But I mean, do we have a sense of why Rishi's done it then?
Yeah, I mean, as I say in the piece, I think there's lots of different factors, but I think one that has become clearer, which I write about, is that this was done less because they thought it was a brilliant time to go and more because of concern of what would have happened if they hadn't gone now. And one factor there was the Rwanda bill and the fact they expected to get a legal challenge on the Rwanda scheme, potentially a Section 39 order, an order from the ECHR to stop it. Now, Rishi Sunak had suggested he was willing to ignore these things, but there was a feeling the Justice Secretary, Alex Chalke, and the Attorney General, Victoria Prentice, were perhaps not willing, and they could resign. Then you, before you know it, could end up in a situation where you have cabinet resignations over a scheme, Tory chaos at a minimum, letters at worst. So I think there's a bit of doing it to avoid lots of these horror scenarios. And now I think that you look at the Tory strategy and what we've seen in the past week or so, and when we go back to that state of discombobulation, you have gaffes, sure, you have a confusing date, and then you have some interesting policies such as mandatory national service, as a, you know, a bung to pensioners. And I think what is dawning on lots of MPs, and also the sense I'm getting from some involved in the campaign, is this is not a strategy to try and win the election and have the biggest political surprise, you know, since Brexit. This is actually a call vote strategy, and what they're trying to do is to stem the losses, stem the bleeding, and get to a point where I think, you know, figures on the campaign and Tory MPs at this point, if the Tories kept 200 Tory MPs, I think that would be seen as a moderate success.
Katie, you quote a former cabinet minister who says, Rishi has been told by strategists, you can't win this. He or she goes on to say 200 MPs would be a success. I suppose that's a surprise in some ways, because what we've seen from you know, various different iterations of Number 10 over the last few years is a kind of failure to face reality. This seems like quite a kind of rational pessimism coming from Number 10.
Exactly, and it's not one you're ever going to hear publicly. You know, a prime minister cannot say, or, you know, a candidate in any election cannot stand up and say, look, I don't think I'm going to win, but give me your vote anyway. So it's almost the elephant in the room, I think. But it also does explain, because lots of MPs wanted them to hold on to autumn in the hope that classic hope in politics are just something would turn up, something would happen. Maybe it's a huge global event they have no importance on, that would, you know, change things. I think Number 10 have come to the conclusion that something was probably not going to turn up and they had to deal with reality. And I think lots of MPs don't accept that reality still. And that's where we're getting at, you know, these different views. And the strategy now is about what can you do to get your Tory vote out. And for the Tories, that vote is 55 for being kind, 65 for being less kind, plus in terms of age groups. And I think that is why you probably will hear some things that are a bit more broad, but there is a very, very specific focus on trying to get the elderly vote back, because it is the bedrock of Tory success in the past. And probably, if you look at the polling, they're just way too behind in the younger groups. I think the middle-aged group, or middle-aged, I'm probably defining the wrong way, the 30-something group, I think that's the group that's particularly angry about mortgages. I think that, you know, the younger groups don't like the Tories, and therefore you're going to get a lot of, you know, grey vote policies as they try and do this, and that links to reform. So I quote in the piece a message that MPs got this week on WhatsApp from one of the campaign coordinators, which is saying, once you finish your initial things of preparing, please get to the seats where there is a Reform Tory vote split, because our number one priority now is trying to stem the Reform vote. Now, the Reform vote is disproportionately older voters.
Do you think, though, that goes against Rishi's instincts, Katie? I mean, as you say in the piece, he's gone from tech bro to pensioner whisperer. Is it going to be a hard sell for him suddenly trying to pivot to appealing to the grey vote?
So I think it's the easier sell for the Tory party brand. But as you say, for Rishi's personal brand, it does slightly go against tech bro, Samba-wearing prime minister, even if his trainer choice, I think we saw, was not particularly popular with perhaps the groups he would like it to be. And I think if you do think of some of his policy stances, so for example, we now have mandatory national service. David Cameron had a non-mandatory scheme about kind of youth volunteers, and founded under the David Cameron era, the package still exists. When Rishi Sunak was Chancellor, and he cut the funding by 2/3. Rishi Sunak was against Boris Johnson's social care policy. He didn't think it was particularly progressive or fair. It helped the rich. It didn't really expand bed capacity. And yet now you look at some of these policies. So I do think it's a bit of a shift for Rishi Sunak. And you will have some people say, no, we're still arguing that he is the only prime minister who is good for the future because he's young and understands AI. But that is not the main message we're getting from the campaign, even if they will say it to you too.
Katie, that's interesting in a way, because I think I've read that Sunak is pursuing a kind of presidential style campaign. I mean, that's interesting on one level, because I think he's polling worse than the party is. But you just said that the party is actually better at making the case to pensioners than Sunak. How does Number 10 square that circle?
Well, I think he can be the person going out there and doing it. I think it's more just, if the campaign's going to choose what they're going to do, it's not the Rishi Sunak pet projects. I think we're seeing that. But also, to your point, I mean, Isaac Levy, the election strategist, told the cabinet around the time of the election being called this would be a presidential campaign. And that definitely led to some sniggering and complaints from cabinet ministers who thought, as you say, with this poll rating, you know, they did it in 2017 with Theresa May when she was ahead. It turned out to be a mistake. She just wasn't a great candidate. And also it was quite a soft, high level of personal approval ratings. I don't think this is a purely presidential campaign. And also, if you look at some of the digital spend at the moment, a lot of it is actually now more going on Conservative branding than Rishi Sunak branding. So perhaps they're changing to a degree. But I think you are seeing a focus on Rishi Sunak just as a way to try and get the attention on Keir Starmer, because CCHQ still think doubts about Keir Starmer as a leader are one of the things they have working in their favour. And to get to that, you that's almost how you become presidential, because it's easier to go after that to say, well, we know what Rishi Sunak thinks on X. What do we know about what Keir Starmer thinks? And I think that's where it's more going.
And just finally, Katie, you conclude your piece by saying that Labour is looking on with some bemusement at all of this and is basically just trying not to make any errors. Can you talk a bit about that side of it?
Yeah, so I think they're going for the Ming Vars strategy of just, you know, trying, it's quite Tony Blair-esque in terms of trying to commit to as little as possible, which is going to tie their hands in government. And as a result, I think the first week or so, it's been going okay for Labour. I don't think people think they're having a fantastic campaign. Keir Starmer sounded a bit uncomfortable on the Today programme in his first interview. You know, Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer's first speeches didn't tell us much, but I don't think that's something Labour really... Labour is not worrying about entertaining people such as us for this podcast. They're just trying to get through it. I think the question for them is, and this is a Tory hope, which is by the time you get to 3-4 weeks in, if Labour really have not said much new, are they going to start to look vacant and so forth? But because they know there's a very high chance, not they want to sound complacent, that they're going into government, they just do not want to put out new pledges. And I think the manifesto is going to be a really interesting point for them, because something gets, you know, some things will be repackaged to sound a bit new, but they're really trying to push or steer away from this idea is going to have much new and exciting in it. But we're seeing one of the problems with that this week, which is if you don't have that much to say about your offer, which is new, and then you have an internal row as Labour having this week with Diane Abbott and whether or not she is allowed to stand as a candidate, reports that she'll be blocked, Keir Starmer not quite knowing what to say on it, but she could be blocked next week when they have to confirm all the candidates, then the focus suddenly goes a lot on that because there's not that much else. So I think that's one of the potential problems for them. But for now, I think they are quite happy just joking about compulsory national service as a teenage dad's army.
Katie, thank you very much. Laura, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
Two things. One is Lucy Denyer writing about how she can't really bear living in a house where she doesn't actually have full ownership of the garden. She says that the Chelsea Flower Show is now particularly torturous to look at from afar. We've also got Peter Parker, who's written a very interesting piece on the history of members of the Household Division of the British Army and their relationships with homosexual men. Peter wrote a brilliant book on this subject, which was reviewed by Matthew Paris a few weeks ago, and he's now returned to The Spectator to write more on the subject.
And actually, a lot of the action happens right opposite our office in St.
It
James's
does indeed,
Park.
It's St. James's Park.
And at the barracks just down the road.
As it happens, Peter has very kindly narrated an extract from his piece, which we can hear here.
During the Victorian period, a gentleman who fancied a bit of scarlet had only to take a stroll in those parts of London where the guards had their barracks. John Addington Symonds recalled being approached one evening in 1865 by a guardsman lurking in a passage near the St George's Barracks in Orange Street. The soldier said he knew a house nearby they could go to, but Symonds was too nervous to take him up on this offer. 12 years later, Symonds was a good deal less shy, and he took time off from giving lectures at the Royal Institute on Florence and the Medici to spend the afternoon with a brawny young soldier at Mrs. Truman's establishment in Albany Street. This house of assignation, masquerading as a tobacconist's, was conveniently situated next door to the Regent's Park Barracks, then home to the Royal Horse Guards. There are lots of houses in London where only soldiers are received and where gentlemen can sleep with them, says a former foot guard in the anonymously authored 1881 novel Sins of the Cities of the Plain, which, although a work of pornography, is generally agreed to provide an accurate account of London's homosexual underworld at this period. Symonds found that his guardsmen looked upon the affair that brought us together in that place from a businesslike and reasonable point of view. For him, at all events, it involved nothing unusual, nothing shameful. Similarly, the soldier in The Sins of the Cities of the Plain explains, "When a young fellow joins, some one of us breaks him in and teaches him the trick, but there's very little need for that, for it seems to come naturally."
What about you, Gus? What did you like?
I particularly enjoyed Nicholas Farrell's Dolce Vita Spec Life column, in which he looks at who his wife might marry after he dies. He says he's a lot older than his wife. And one of them is a cowboy, an Italian cowboy who owns some donkeys. And his prize donkey he won in a poker game. It's just a funny, very enjoyable column from Nick. Next, Angus Colwell writes about the rise of political spinfluencers on social media, particularly on TikTok. He says that there's a battle for young people's attention and that the parties are only just getting to grips with how this new form of social media works. In fact, TikTok didn't really factor at all in the 2019 general election. And yet now the parties seem to be fighting it out on the app. To discuss further, Angus joined me with Harry Boken, who runs the Champagne Socialist TikTok account. Angus, in the magazine this week, you write about the different social media strategies, particularly the TikTok strategies of the political parties in the general election. And you write about the rise of politics influencers. Can you tell us which side of the political spectrum is winning?
With TikTok's audience, so TikTok's audience is obviously likely to be young. They're more likely to skew slightly to the left, obviously. But I think any party that wins on TikTok is basically going to have to make the funniest content, tap into sort of like ironic stuff, do lots of memes. Both Labour and the Tories have so far gone for a mix of memes. Labour yesterday mocked Rishi Sunak's footballing ability, and the Lib Dems have just done that this afternoon. Whereas the Conservatives, they haven't really gone down the path of trying to be particularly funny. There's a Rishi Sunak's first video. He sort of is standing there in his shirt and he says, sorry to be breaking into your usual politics-free feed. And it's a little bit cringe. And so, I mean, Labour have got more engagement. They've got more followers so far. But that probably is to be expected, considering there's probably quite a wide audience for mocking Rishi Sunak on TikTok.
Harry, do you think that the prevalence of left-wing memes and videos on TikTok is purely down to the viewership, the people that use the app, or do you think it's something else? Do you think maybe the left are learning to meme?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. To answer your question, I think it's a bit of a mix. I would say, yeah, I would say that you're right. TikTok, I would imagine, would lean more to the left. Younger people tend to lean more to the left of politics. In terms of the memes, I mean, I've seen a couple of them and they are kind of funny. I mean, I just hope the policies are as good as the memes. And then, to be honest, I don't think some of the memes are really that great. You know, the one that they did with Michael Owen from the, I think it was the Euros or the World Cup in 1998. You know, that's probably not going to cut through as well. If they'd use someone like Jude Bellingham, for example, that would have been perhaps more relevant given the whole national service thing. TikTok's a very interesting one. And I think if that's seen as a political battleground, that would be quite interesting. But then social media has been arguably since 2010. You know, in 2010, it was Facebook, then and Twitter. And then in 2015, again, Twitter, Facebook, and then sort of the introduction of Instagram. And then by 2019, I mean, you had the Conservative Party spending, I think, at least $500,000 on Facebook, targeted Facebook ads alone. So I think politicians are recognising the power of social media. And also around Europe, we're seeing that as well.
Harry, you run a TikTok account called The Champagne Socialist. Can you just tell us what you do on the app?
Yeah, I basically sort of talk about what's going on in British politics. I'm kind of strictly focused on British politics. And then also in terms of, say, when we talk about foreign policy, the UK government's involvement. I've been producing political content for nearly 4 years now since October 2020. I've amassed, I want to say, like 175,000 followers, something like that, over the last 4 years. And yeah, I do a video a day, maybe sometimes two, depending on if I have enough time in the day. And yeah, I mean, it's very sort of fast paced. You know, you do a video that you think is going to be relevant by 8 o'clock when I post, and then by 7 o'clock, so they've said something else, and then you perhaps have to change it, or you just don't post. So it's very interesting, and I really enjoy it.
Angus, Harry mentioned there that often what he does is he's just kind of giving his opinion to camera, and actually that's sort of similar in a way to the Sunak strategy of him there in his shirt, kind of giving you his opinion. Do you think those kinds of videos work, or do you think they really need to rely on humour to cut through?
Well, I'm on TikTok and I don't necessarily get them. Your audience already has to be engaged. Your audience...
You don't get what, sorry?
I don't get political content coming up on my TikTok. Right. It's not, I just get old football goals and recipes and things like that. And that's probably true for a lot of people that use TikTok. I think that you need an already engaged audience who are interested in politics. It won't necessarily come up on your feed if you're not already engaged. On humour, I think that the parties particularly are going to have to use humour because TikTok doesn't allow paid political ads. So you sort of need to, your content will always go so far as, you know, people want it to. Whereas on Facebook and Instagram, you can see much more, you know, they're much more lax with that. So yeah, I think the parties do have to rely on humour a lot more on TikTok. But I don't know how far it's going to go, because if you're a political party and you want your message being put out on TikTok, you basically need a group of people who really like your party. People like Harry, I hope he doesn't mind me saying, you know, his username suggests that he is on the left, you know. There are other TikTokers I spoke to who are on the right. None of them are sort of party political. No one's, you know, No one really likes Rishi Sunak or really likes Keir Starmer. People at Harry are going to make videos about the strikes, or people might make videos about the war in Gaza, and people on the right I spoke to will make videos about levels of immigration they think are too high. It's very, very rare at the moment to find young people making political content who have a party, who are party political.
Harry, what is it that drives you to make these videos?
Well, originally it was a university project. During my second year of my degree, I studied in Leicester, for context, and obviously we were in a different tier of restrictions during the pandemic. And one of the modules we were doing was called Politics in Action. And typically pre-COVID, you would have gone into the local community and worked with, say, a homeless shelter, a food bank, local authority, that sort of thing. So when I sort of started it, it was a case of, well, you can use social media because obviously with the restrictions. So I was just commenting on what was going on at the time. So I'd say in terms of my motivations, I think it's something I'm interested in. And I think that's like the key thing. It's something that interests me. I've been interested in politics since I was about 14, 15 years old. That was the EU 2014 elections was like the first election I properly remember. And I remember being interested and I was reading about it. And I think my parents sort of caught on to that and sort of tried helping me sort of understand things more. A lot of my early political influences are my parents, as I'm sure many other people's are. So I'd say in terms of my motivations with what I do now, I think it's because people clearly liked what I had to say and liked how I put it across. And what you mentioned about the humour, Angus, I think that is a thing there. Like, you know, for me, one of my big interests is football. And I try and sort of incorporate sort of jokes about football within the within my video. So an example I would give was, I'm sure we all remember Rishi Sunak at the site of at the shipyard where the Titanic was built. And the journalist said, "Are you captaining a sinking ship?" And I said, "Well, at this rate, political journalists are going to be scoring more tap-ins than Pippo and Zaghi." And people will sort of catch on to it. And no one laughed. That's all good.
I know nothing about football.
As for the humour part, I think, yeah, being funny is good. But obviously, like, funny only gets you so far. And we're not electing comedians. We're electing politicians who are going to decide where our country goes. So, you know, let's focus less on the comedy and more on the policy.
Angus, I suppose one of the interesting things for perhaps older listeners is that when you go on TikTok, and I've spent a little bit of time on TikTok, you find that often the things that cut through are not from kind of credentialed individuals. These are not necessarily experts. They seem to be people that you know are quite normal and are just quite passionate about a topic. Why do you think that is?
I think that there's fewer media gatekeepers on TikTok. I mean, the way that you would have seen credentialed people on television is if they appear on Question Time or something, if they do an interview with a newspaper. That doesn't really happen on TikTok. You know, the legacy media brands struggle to, you know, a lot of them do have followings on TikTok, but that's not what drives things. I mean, it really is the content and how many views things ratchet up. TikTok's much more anarchic than any other social media site that we've previously had, you know, which is why I think, you know, none of the parties were thinking about it until last week. They clearly went, oh Christ, we better be on this, you know, because they must have seen some stats that lots of people use it for a long time as well. People stay on TikTok for a long time. I mean, I hope it stays anarchic. I think that's why it's good. I think it's good that, like, there isn't a media brand that filters out which kind of voices you see on there. Mm. It's probably to do with that.
Finally, Harry, Angus mentions in his piece that Labour has just hired a TikTok advisor. That seems kind of antithetical to the anarchic vibe of the platform. Do you think that'll work for them?
I've seen some of their videos and they seem to be doing quite well. They rely heavily on like reposting, for example, same with like Twitter with retweets and stuff like that. I honestly don't know. I mean, when I speak to a lot of people at my age, they don't know how they're going to vote. And to be honest, I don't think a silly TikTok video is necessarily going to sway people. You know, I'm 23 years old and I'm already content with the idea that I'll never own my own home. And I don't want to be feeling that way. And I know a lot of other young people feel the same way. We want to see policy, not memes. You know, I can laugh at a meme, but I can't live in a meme, can I? The same with like public services as well. We want to see investment. We want to see commitment. But again, with TikTok, I think it's interesting. And obviously with the election that's going on, it's good for content. It's nice that people see me as a news source. I always tell people to branch out because I'm incredibly biased, as are all sort of news platforms anyway. But one of the points that you mentioned, Angus, with sort of the anarchic structure, I completely agree with. You know, before with journalists, if they had a big story, they'd have to sort of time it for the 12, 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock news, but they'd be competing against so many other stories. Now with stuff like TikTok, for example, they can post it at any time with any other social media platform and then it can just gain the engagement from there. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting and how political parties navigate it. I did think the Lib Dems one was quite funny with using a peep show over Rishi Sunak playing football. That was quite interesting. But again, policy over memes. That's my, you know, enough said.
Harry, Angus, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally, should the West be paying more attention to China's space ventures? Dr. David Whitehouse, author of Space 2069, The Future of Space Exploration, writes in the magazine this week about China's latest lunar mission, expected to land on the moon in the coming week. He contrasts the patriotism of China's space exploration with the struggle by Western governments to generate excitement about space. He joined us to discuss, along with journalist, broadcaster and author of The Future of Geography, Tim Marshall. David, in the magazine this week, you write about China's recent mission to the moon, which is expected to land in the coming week. You say it's both significant and historic. Can you tell listeners a bit about why that is?
Well, China has great ambitions for the moon, and it regards it as a very interesting sort of prize, because in its drive to become, over the next few decades, the premier superpower in the world, it feels it can't be so unless it's got the leading space program in the world. And it's looked around at the declining space program of the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and also the problems that America has had with getting started, with moving away from going round the Earth in low Earth orbit. And they've had a strategic plan now for 20 years at least to slowly build up their capabilities. And they are the only nation that's landed on the far side of the moon. As you say, in the next few days, their mission will be landing there for the second time, and they will return the first ever samples from the far side of the moon. And they have the large space station that they're building in Earth orbit. They have plans for Mars and for the other planets. So this is a symbol of their future ambition and intention to actually be the world's leading space power.
And Tim, David mentions in his piece that China will be raising the Communist Party flag, not just on the moon, but actually specifically in a crater named after the first American moon landing, the Apollo crater. That's quite a statement, isn't it?
It's very symbolic, and it may be simply for scientific reasons that that's the best place to get as deep as you can to then learn about the formation of the moon and the solar system. But even if it was a coincidence, and it may not be, it will not have passed them by that they are raising the flag of the CCP on something called Apollo, and it's on top of it. And so it's a sort of signal that they are, I don't think they are ahead of the Americans yet, but they intend to be ahead of the Americans, and they probably will be.
That's a very good point. Yes, they have a plan. The Americans can respond to China's ambitions on the moon and say, yes, they're finally returning to the moon. But they're doing so in a much more ambitious and technologically advanced way than they did in the Apollo program. And what China is doing is redoing the Apollo program with astronauts by the end of this decade that they can say America did 50 plus years ago. But you're quite right. It is their future. They do not plan, as the Americans did, to turn their backs on the moon. And we have to look at this over the next two decades to see how America gets on with its space ambitions and how China responds. There was an interesting interview in the American government and Congress when the head of NASA a few years ago was very sanguine about the fact that the next boots on the moon may be Chinese and not American. And he was very easy about this. The Right Honourable Representative for Texas, which is where the Houston Space Center is, was not. And he took it as a personal insult and said that it would be a disaster for American pride, if having said they're going to go back to the moon, the Chinese beat them. Well, it's a race at the moment, certainly.
And Tim, one of the points that David makes is that China manages to blend its space strategy with this sense of patriotism in a way that the West perhaps seems to be failing to do. Why do you think that is? And is there anything that can be done to rectify that?
They do it because they absolutely buy at the highest levels, by which I mean President Xi, they buy into the concept that first does matter. I mean, there's a whole debate about, does it matter about being first or whether you're fifth or sixth, but become the most successful? I think it does matter if you're first for those symbolic reasons. But they've also made it a sort of national endeavor to engender the patriotism behind it, because they know the value of it. And the fusion of the civil-military aspects of the space program I don't really see that much division between the two. Whereas in the United States, yes, obviously there is cooperation between the commercial sector and the government sector, but they are distinct entities. It's really not like that in China. It is a single aim and a fusion between the two, because they realize this is worth the gamble, and it is a gamble, because the riches and the success you can get from it, we don't even know yet the potential. A couple of quick examples. There's the commercial side of it, of mining. Now, the economics of that are a long way from satisfactory, but you're not going to miss the opportunity to have what might be the oil of the 21st century, which you can find there in the rare earth metals. You're not going to miss the scientific achievements that you could make. And then you're not going to miss the potential military advantages that being the dominant force in space, low Earth orbit, geosynchronous orbit, and then on the moon is going to give you. And the last one, and this is more outlandish, in the event that we ever crack nuclear fusion, there is lots of helium-3 on the moon. The Chinese believe there's enough helium-3 on the moon to power Earth's needs for 10,000 years. And that is radiation-free nuclear power. So are you really going to miss that? They get all that and they buy into it at the top level. Sorry, and to the second bit of your question, yes, the Americans can do it, but it means it takes the president driving it. Now, what Biden has done is handed over most of the responsibility, political oversight, to Kamala Harris, the vice president, which to me sends a signal that, you know, he doesn't view it as a significant priority for the United States.
And David, you mentioned in your piece that actually, to some extent, this is America's fault because they banned the Chinese from cooperating with NASA or any US company that is attempting to get into space. And that's really kind of given the Chinese impetus to kind of go their own way. And actually, they've been teaming up with some of the nations that make up the European Space Agency. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, China's, as Tim said, China's done this very intelligently. They've been very clever. And they would have probably gone their own way in many respects, even if they couldn't, if they could have cooperated with the West. But there was a time when they did want more cooperation, particularly when the International Space Station was being built. They saw themselves as being, even before they put their first astronauts in space, they saw themselves as being an up-and-coming space power, which they were. But America, because of the technology transfer problems, because they couldn't be sure if any satellite was sent to China for a launch, and this is why China's commercial aims of launching satellites for commercial customers never got anywhere, because they were worried that, you know, the satellite on its way to the launch pad, somebody would open it up and have a look, see how it worked, and look at the computer program, look at the chips. The technology transfer was a big problem because this technology, satellites are high technology, could have found its way into the military. So that did not work. So on the one hand, they tried to play it both ways in the sense they wanted to cooperate with the West, go their own way and use the West. I mean, they've used the West very intelligently. I mean, their space capsule that they send astronauts into space in is a derivative, upgraded derivative of the Soyuz capsule used by the Russians. So they've been very clever. And it's a bit simplistic to say that they were so insulted that they couldn't cooperate with the West that they went their own way. They were clever enough to realize they had to go along both these paths at the same time.
If I could briefly add to that, I completely understand the American rationale. I mean, the Chinese are world champions at stealing intellectual property. And they even stole some of the space tech from the Russians. The Russians got a bit suspicious and decided they were going to transfer some of the Chinese, this is a couple of decades ago, transfer some scientists back to China. And they took with them as much tech as they could have got hold of. So the Wolf Amendment, which David's referring to, which bans NASA from working, you can understand the rationale, but it's a bit of a blunt instrument. And I think they would have been better to have been more sophisticated to at least have symbolic partnership with the Chinese. But what is happening is that there is a bloc going up led by China with Russia, North Korea, Iran, on one side, and on the other side, the American-led bloc. And this mirrors the political tensions on Earth. So I don't see that issue of division is going to be resolved soon.
Quite right, quite right.
Tim and David, thank you very much for joining.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for this week. But if you enjoyed this podcast, you can pick up a copy of the magazine to read everything we've discussed and much, much more. I'm Gus Carter.
And I'm Laura Prendergast. And we hope you join us again next week.